Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is a syndicated show produced in the studios of CJSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
How do we create a different world, a better world? Why is it necessary to live within the kind of constraints in normative understandings and normative practices that we have in our society? We can remake the society. We can rebuild it.
That's the voice of renowned author and educator Dr. Peter McLaren. On this week's show, we speak to Peter McLaren about the role of critical pedagogy in the globalization era and discussing hope and strategy through education. So stay tuned.
Our lives are created and constructed through the many stories that speak to what we consider to be the most important things, the things that we care about, that we passionately advocate and work towards and collaborate with others to create and imagine. You know, I think that moment of speaking our truth, that moment of speaking our stories is now. That moment takes different forms in different places. We can create amazing things. And someone who has been working not only to help us imagine a different society, but also to imagine different ways to engage one another, particularly within the academy, is my next guest. Dr. Peter McLaren is the author of over 40 books. He is an amazing academic and professor. I love your work. I'm very privileged to have you on our program. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure, indeed.
Now, when you talk about education, you know, we seem to be in a bit of a dead-end street at times, because while we talk about improving pedagogical practices, which means the way we teach, we keep ignoring the content, you know, that we impart to our students. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the impact that this has in the long run for education, the implications that it has for education, but more importantly, the implications that this has for a society.
I think that's a great question. I think it's important that we understand education from the perspective of a really powerful singular goal. So when I look at education, I look at education to create a better world. I mean, that has to be the larger issue. How can we, in every facet of what we do as educators, whether we're public school teachers, elementary school teachers, or university professors, we need to look at our work not simply as academics, but as people involved in political and social and cultural projects. So for me, I look at how education in the larger sense socially reproduces relations of power and privilege that support the transnational capitalist class. So for me, the fundamental goal of all education is to educate for a democratic socialist alternative to the kind of society we're living in now. And so I look at education as a form of social reproduction. In other words, I try to fathom how schools are implicated in this process of social reproduction. That is, how do schools perpetuate, or how do they reproduce, the social relationships and the attitudes needed to sustain the existing dominant economic and class relations of the larger society? So, Sylvie, that's the kind of larger lens through which I look at all education. And that's something that I think we need to keep in mind.
I think that that's such an important point to make, because while we live in a society where we're, you know, filled with complexity and many points that reinforce those structures that you describe, that recreate and maintain power in the hands of a few at the and displace and, you know, deny life's chances to millions of people, education provides us with a window of opportunity, and that's how I see it, as an opportunity to create something else. Now, your work has taken some inspiration from the works of Paulo Freire, and he advocated for a pedagogy of emancipation, an emancipatory pedagogy. What do you imagine that would be like, and how do we begin that work that connects us not only to the students within the academy, but also to communities outside the academy?
I think that's a tremendous question. It's interesting because, you know, Paulo Freire, the great Brazilian educator and the author of Pedagogy of the Oppressed, he was certainly a fundamental inspiration in my life as an educator. And I owe so much to people like Paulo Freire, like Henry Giroux, like Donaldo Macedo, and others. And what Paulo told me one day was, it's something that he shared with many people, not just me. But Paulo said, look, reinvent me in the context in which you find yourselves. Just don't take, you know, a single model of social emancipation or educational emancipation and try to take that single model and apply it in different contexts around the world. He said, reinvent the notion of liberation in the context in which you find yourself. So for me, it's not a question of finding the correct pedagogical methodology. Critical pedagogy is not a methodology. It's not a how-to. It's not a system of you know, do this and then do this and then do this. It's actually a philosophy of praxis. Not practice, but praxis. That's P-R-A-X-I-S. And that means a combination of theory and practice, where, you know, practice creates theory, theory creates practice. They're not separate entities. So, for instance, something I think is important is to look at critical pedagogy in this manner. Critical pedagogy in emancipatory education begins with making education relevant to the lives of learners. That is to say, critical pedagogy approaches education with looking at what young people or adults or whomever you're working with, they have a rich fund of knowledge. They come with incredible experiences, and these experiences are really important, and they need to be valued, and they need to be appreciated and celebrated, people's experiences that they already have in life. But it's not enough simply to make education relevant. Education needs to be relevant in order to become critical. That is to say, a lot of young people or adults or learners, their experiences are valid, but they may be prejudiced, they may be racist, they may be sexist, and educators need to challenge the experiences of many people, because experiences never speak for themselves. So while you want to value experiences, you want to also challenge how people interpret their experiences. Now, that's a difficult pedagogical task. So for me, the question is this: how do you challenge somebody's experiences and opinions without taking their voice away? Because to be voiceless is to be powerless. So that's the art of critical pedagogy. Now, it's not enough to be critical. You need to be critical in order to be transformative. So there's really three steps here. Education needs to be relevant in order to be critical, in order to be transformative, so that all fundamental knowledge, I believe, needs to be put in the service of building a new world in which needless suffering and needless pain and needless oppression it can be eliminated. And so for me, that's the fundamental goal. You bring everything back to that. How do we create a different world, a better world? Why is it necessary to live within the kind of constraints in normative understandings and normative practices that we have in our society? We can remake the society. We can rebuild it. And one way to do this, it's not a sufficient way, it's only a partial way, is, I believe, the practice of critical pedagogy. I'm talking to you right now from La Paz, Mexico, and I'm going to be off to Morelia. I'm going to be off to Jalisco, to Guadalajara, back to Ensenada, and I'm meeting with critical educators. And, you know, I'm coming from, you know, originally from Canada. It's my native country. I've been living in the U.S. I've been working throughout Latin America and Europe with emancipatory educators, and all of us agree on the fundamental principles of what we're doing, but the content of our approaches may differ. And I guess, and should differ, of course.
I'm so happy you brought that point, because I'm being from Latin America, I'm always conflicted with the question, evolution or revolution?
And
and I'm coming to the side of revolution. And I think revolution takes many forms, and it encompasses a great complexity of context and who we are in that context and the possibilities, right, of that historical moment that we live, depending on where you are at that moment. Today, I look around and I see fires of revolutions, you know, worldwide. We look at Greece and we know that people are standing up against austerity. We look at Spain, and the movement of the indignados is taking over, you know, not just the realms of civil society, but also governments are having to be responsive. And of course, the examples of the Tunisian uprising, Egypt, all of these things, you know, are sources of inspiration. In my opinion, they're seeds of people speaking of a different possibility. You know, these are peaceful resistance, and yet very revolutionary in the ideas that they're proposing. I guess as an academic, as a professor, someone who has the ears and audience of you know, thousands of students, what do you feel is our responsibility as an institution of learning, and what ought to be our response to this moment, in my opinion, pregnant with possibility?
I think that's a really important point. You know, some professors see their roles as academics, and obviously they try to survive within the system. They're on the publishing, and they're on the that kind of track. I've never really seen my work. I suppose early on I did, but for the last at least 20 years, I really haven't seen my role as an academic at UCLA, where I'm currently returning after a brief sojourn at the University of Auckland. I've always seen my work as part of a larger political project. So for me, that's how I view the kind of work that I do. And I suppose I've been fortunate in the sense that, you know, I do publish a lot, but the work that I publish is work that's connected to a larger politics of liberation. I co-edited a book with Steve Best and Tony Nocella called Academic Repression, and I think it came out with AK Press about a year or two ago, and it documents, it contains testimonies from professors, progressive professors, testimonies about how they've been treated and had their voices silenced, or how the administrations and universities have attempted to silence their voices. We have a tremendous number of really accomplished scholars who have spoken out in this book about attempts to silence their voices. I think that usually in universities, left-wing or progressive or radical professors are tolerated as long as they keep their activism to just publications in scholarly journals that have a very narrow audience. But once you start to connect with social movements, once you start to connect with organizations, indigenous groups, for instance, who are struggling, once you make transnational connections and there is a momentum that is caught up with your work in terms of what's being shaped on the ground, then universities become very, very nervous, because universities, largely speaking, are large corporations. They're receiving funding now. Even pedagogical schools, you know, schools of education, teacher education institutions are receiving funding from corporate donors and sponsors. And so they're not interested in a larger educational vision, which actually undermines their own very source of existence. So it becomes very, very, very difficult. But there are spaces of hope. You know, I tend to think of Tupac Shakur and when he talked about roses that grow up through the cracks in the concrete. I mean, capitalism, it's totalizing, but it's not total. In other words, the genocide, the exploitation of human labor and non-human labor, the destruction of the biosphere that we're seeing, imperialist wars over resources, all of these assaults on humanity are not seamless. You know, I mean, I tend to think of capitalism as tectonic plates, you know, that kind of shift. And when they do, fissures and cracks open up and can lead to what some people have called, you know, spaces of hope. So that the kinds of oppression that we're seeing around the world, forms of domination, forms of exploitation, they all have a contradictory character. And there are always cracks and fissures in which, you know, we can step into and we can try to enlarge. And the other thing that we have to understand is that indigenous groups, for instance, have always been fighting. I mean, they've been fighting for the last 500 years, and they have never stopped. And those are struggles that we need to continue to ally ourselves with. The struggles of indigenous communities and working class communities, and we need to make alliances on both local and transnational scale. And there's one other thing that I need to mention too, because you talked about the evolution of revolution. The kind of position that I take has one fundamental question that has to be posited before we do anything, and that is, we have to ask ourselves, why have so many revolutions turned into their opposite? In other words, why have so many well-intentioned struggles for the emancipation of humanity ended up in totalitarian dictatorships? And why have so many revolutions in the past failed or become the opposite of what they started out to be? And these are questions we need to ask ourselves. And I think one of the answers to that question is that the left has really not been able to articulate a vision of what a truly free and democratic society would look like outside of the value production of capitalism. In other words, we really need to create a viable alternative to transnational globalized capitalism that absolutely makes sense and captures the hearts and the minds of people so that they're willing to invest in this new vision of what a world could possibly look like. And that's a difficult task, and it's a task that universities and intellectuals and workers and people on the ground, all of us should be working towards thinking about what that social universe outside of capitalism might look like and how to ensure that we can find true, authentic freedom within that vision. Because we know that many revolutions in the past turned into horror stories, and we want to avoid that. But that doesn't mean we should cease the struggle. That doesn't mean we should stop fighting. Just because many attempts in the past have turned out to be nightmares doesn't mean that the whole idea of struggling against capitalism is wrong. I believe that it's right, and I believe we have no alternative. I don't believe we can find true democracy and true freedom within the whole ambit of capitalism. I don't think we can. We need an alternative, but we need an alternative that isn't going to become despotic. We need an alternative where human creativity can flourish, and we can truly find the kind of freedom that all of us deserve and the dignity in our lives that all of us deserve.
We're speaking with Dr. Peter McLaren. He is the author of over 40 books. His latest book is Revolutionizing Pedagogy, Educating for Social Justice Within and Beyond Global Neoliberalism. He's also a co-author with Nochella and Bess of Academic Repression, Reflections from the Academy Industrial Complex. Both of your books speak to this notion of a revolutionary pedagogy. What inspires you to struggle within the academy? What keeps you, you know, going when you're feeling that in spite of your everyday efforts, you know, transformation is not happening overnight?
Right. And as a matter of fact, it's really difficult because things are getting worse in many respects. I mean, when I first left Canada in 1985 and went to the U.S., I was working with Henri Giroux, whose work I greatly respect and admire. And we were fighting, you know, to create an educational system that would help produce democratic citizens. And that was our goal. And I really believed that the struggle was going to lead to something important and to lead to important outcomes. And there were the conservatives that had their vision of what democratic citizen should look like. There were liberals that had their own vision, and there were radicals. And we would all enter debates in the journals and in conferences and sometimes in public forums, and we would all debate our particular perspectives. And then, in 1985, this is my view of what happened. Around 1985, it became clear that corporations were actually becoming more powerful in many ways than countries, than states. Not in every way, of course not, but in many important respects, corporations began to exercise more power and more influence than countries. And when that happened, the shift moved from the education of democratic citizens to the education of corporate citizens. And the emphasis in education from the university all the way through to elementary school became educating for consumption. What did George Bush ask everyone to do after September the 11th, 2001? He said the best thing that, that Americans or U.S. citizens could do was go shopping. So that's been a tremendous shift. And I think that the battle for democracy in education has been pretty much lost everywhere. When you look at the growth of charter schools, the privatization of education, the commodification of education, the businessification of education, nobody's talking about democracy anymore. Everyone's talking about educating a kind of workforce that will be good consumers and will basically become sort of consumer citizens and look at consumption as a form of some is basically a lifestyle. I'm not optimistic about the future, but I am hopeful. And I don't mean hope in the Barack Obama sense. I mean a kind of radical hope that you can't give up the fight and you can never stop the struggle because you never know what openings might occur in the future. But things have really gotten worse. Civil rights has retreated, you know, back to almost the pre-1950s in the United States. So I've seen a lot of gains actually just disappear and dry up. So it's really hard to keep hope alive. I spend a lot of time with communities of struggle, and it's the people and getting to know the people on the ground that have really humbled me and made me feel, almost ashamed of sometimes the despair that I fall into. Because here these groups are, and I meet with them all the time, that live in very humble circumstances, that are feeding themselves from day to day. They don't know how they're going to provide for themselves or their families. And in seeing their spirits and being emboldened by their spirits really helps to keep me going. Without my relationships with people on the ground and with groups on the ground, I would probably sink into a really bad state of despair. But seeing people with courage and commitment that humbles me keeps me thinking that the struggle can never be over, as long as there are people like the people that I meet in my daily educational travels and practices. I'm always going to be there, standing beside them.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much for being with us. It's been a real privilege. How can our audience access your books?
I've got a number of websites and lists of my books, or you just, I guess, hit Amazon.com, Peter McLaren, and they pretty much bring up lists of my books.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
lo superficial cambia también lo profundo.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program produced and broadcast from the studios of CGSF Radio in Burnaby, BC. The program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com. Bye for now.